First of all, again, thank you for having me here. It's been a pleasure. I'll be here till Friday evening. Solid inflation. This talk is entirely contained in a paper with these two lovely gentlemen here. But just as an initial sort of disclaimer, there's also work done by these other folks. Gruzinov, I think, in like around 2004, and then I think Spergel and Bucher in, I don't know, maybe 2001 or something, that actually utilizes essentially the same effective field theory. It's not that this idea is entirely new, but I think our emphasis on the symmetry breaking pattern, we've computed new quantities in it, and especially with respect to inflation. So this, for instance, was a model about basically dark energy with stable perturbations. But there's something special about using a solid versus using a fluid, and that's exactly why especially this author needed it. It's not, you know, the most, everything is not new, but I think we have a new take on it. Okay, so let's begin. Okay, so I'd like to start with maybe giving a little bit of background on what is sort of, in some sense, the standard technique when it comes to thinking about perturbations in inflation is this effective field theory of inflation. So developed by these folks here, the basic idea with the effective field theory of inflation is that somehow you're always having the same set of dynamics occurring in the early universe. And what you want is you want something which will generically characterize all models which have the same sort of set of features. So in particular, what you want is you want a universe that is basically homogeneous and isotropic, and you need it to be time-dependent. You want it to be time-dependent in a way such that it's basically inflating, but the time dependence is key for having it stop. So you don't want it to be exactly de Sitter. You want something which has some non-trivial evolution. And what you're going to have, in order to have some time dependence, is you're going to have a field or some set of fields that drives this time dependence. We can just call it psi. And because this psi has some sort of vacuum expectation value, that's what this over bar is supposed to mean, it spontaneously breaks time translations. So when you spontaneously break time translations, you have Goldstone bosons. These Goldstone bosons, you can think of the usual cosmological adiabatic perturbations. And that's because if you were to write here's your vacuum expectation value, you add some generic fluctuation, you can sort of always rewrite that generic fluctuation by pulling out this piece here. So you can always think of some kind of spatial and time-dependent fluctuations as just some sort of spatial shift in time, which is exactly how you think about the adiabatic perturbation. So the idea is, in the effective field theory of inflation, you take the main ingredient that is driving inflation. You know that it's going to have some vacuum expectation value that depends on time. You know the symmetry breaking pattern. So you know the degrees of freedom, namely what's left is your adiabatic perturbation, and then also the degrees of freedom in your metric. You know the symmetry breaking pattern. You construct an effective field theory, and in some sense, that should describe all cosmology. So this should work also with non-inflationary scenarios. Again, you just want some time dependence. So in some sense, all cosmology should be contained in this model. Of course, there's more rich structure, but at first pass, this is basically the story. So in particular, when people write down things like multi-field models, the first question you should ask is somehow, what is basically the analog of this field? And then you can always add sort of extra crap on top, which is just going to sort of futz with the dynamics, but the main point is always going to be the same. So in particular, you can make sort of model-independent predictions about, let's say, the different sorts of shapes of non-Gaussianity you can have, the size of these non-Gaussianities, the tilt of various spectra. So it's a very, very powerful method. Okay, so what we would like to say is that there's actually a different way of doing exactly the same thing. And it seems very odd at first. So let's consider a different symmetry breaking pattern. So we have our fundamental field that is driving inflation, but instead of having a time-dependent background, we have an x-dependent background. Okay, so time translations will be unbroken, but spatial translations are broken. So this seems to be in violation with two sort of sacred principles of cosmology, or I mean, maybe they're so obvious that we don't even think of them as principles, but we want the universe to be homogeneous and isotropic, which some sort of x-dependent background immediately seems to violate. And then we also need some sort of clock for the same reasons that we introduced this field that had time dependence in the first place when we were talking about the effective field theory of inflation. Okay, so it seems like a crazy idea, but we can have internal symmetries of our field that basically make this seemingly non-homogeneous and isotropic vacuum expectation value give us homogeneous and isotropic physical observables. So for instance, the pressure, the density. So we can take care of that with internal symmetries. And then we are the clock of our field is no longer going to be our fundamental fields, our fundamental sort of matter fields here. Really, the clock is going to be the metric. And we'll see exactly how that works in a moment. OK, so let's begin with the internal symmetries. So let's try a single scalar field. So we have phi is equal to x. Let's give it just a simple vacuum expectation value. Now, if we have an internal shift symmetry, so phi goes to phi plus a, then there's going to be an unbroken diagonal translation, both in field space and in physical space, that's going to give you homogeneity, right? But if we have a single field, the problem is we cannot have isotropy, right? If we just have a single field, we can't fix the problems with that this guy will break rotations. So in order to fix that, we're going to need three fields. Okay, so now we have three fields labeled by some internal index whose background expectation value is just x, xi, xyz. And instead of having in addition to having an internal shift, we have an internal SO3 symmetry. Again, there's going to be some unbroken diagonal rotation. So in some sense, if you do a physical rotation in space, you can undo that with an internal rotation in field coordinates. And we can recover isotropy. So a system with three scalar fields with these internal symmetries, I would like to say, describes a solid. Sometimes the word solid is confusing only because people immediately think of crystals. So this really isn't a crystal. It's more like a perfect jelly thing. But jelly inflation doesn't sound particularly appealing. Maybe that's just an American bias. Anyways, so this sort of effective field theory was first written down by these folks here, just as to mention it. So let me convince you that this is, in fact, a solid. Okay, so how would we describe a solid? So forgetting about cosmology for a moment. Okay, so there's one way of describing a solid, which is that you have basically a set of points living inside some medium, and you basically want to describe each one of them by the world lines. So for each point, you can follow its position as a function of time. So that would be sort of this coordinate choice, right? But because we have a three-dimensional medium, we can map back to the other choice of coordinates, which is that we can simply ask at any given point and time what co-moving volume element is there. So that's sort of the meaning of this coordinate choice here. So here you have some solid system, some jelly, and you simply label each piece by these internal coordinates. And you follow, as a function of space and time, what internal coordinates are there. So the material elements sort of flow by you, and you ask who's there at what particular point and time. Okay? And so we know the degrees of freedom of a solid. What are the symmetries? Well, it's going to be no surprise. It's the symmetries that we were just talking about. So let's choose a background that makes this manifest. So let's just choose a the background configuration to just be the solid sitting there, some pressure, some temperature, it has some density. So what the easiest way to map the internal coordinates to the spatial coordinates is just have, again, phi I equals xi. So this is just labeling each volume element by where he is. Okay? Now we want to have some shift symmetry because where we start that isn't actually important. So physically we need a shift symmetry. This is going to give us sort of derivative terms in the action. We're also going to need Lorentz invariants. So since we're going to need derivatives for our shift symmetry, we're going to need to contract these derivatives in a Lorentz invariant way. That gives us this metric Bij defined this way. And now we also want our solid to be isotropic. And so we need this SO3 internal invariance, which is going to give us these three different combinations of this metric, which are going to be the building blocks of our theory. So these brackets just basically represent trace. So this would be B squared, for instance, would be this metric. So Bij, Bj, I, for instance, would be this thing here. Yeah, exactly. Okay. So these are going to be, like I said, these are going to be the building blocks of our theory. But for a moment, let me just discuss perfect fluids because they are also described with the same set of symmetries and the same degrees of freedom, plus one. Plus one meaning we have this additional volume-preserving diffeomorphism. So a fluid is special in comparison to a solid, because what I can do is I can take the volume elements and in an adiabatic, sort of infinitely slow way, I can reorganize them, let them go, and the energy of the system won't have changed. Whereas if I have a solid, you know, a lattice of springs, it knows that it's been displaced from its rest value and it wants to return there. So one way to think about this is that the actual sort of transverse modes of your system have no gradient term. So you're not punished for any sort of any non-compressional motion. Okay?
Yeah? I'm not sure it's about the sound of speed and the shear rate of speed in this kind of action.
Yeah. Okay. So the way to think about, okay, so you have this additional symmetry, which can be described by this. So we basically, we go to another set of internal coordinates. We want this determinant to be one. And what that requires is out of those three degrees of sort of those three elements that we had, these guys here, there's a linear combination of them, non-linear combination of them. But there's a combination of them that gives us the determinant, and it's the determinant that is invariant under this additional symmetry. So you can really think of a perfect fluid as actually being a very, very symmetric solid. Okay? We'll come back to this a little later. Okay. So,
I didn't really follow it. So how did we get that? How did we get this determinant?
No. You can compress the system, but when you compress the system, the energy changes. So the point is, any non-compressional time-independent change will not change the system. So it's a symmetry of your action, let's say.
Is any non-compressional rotation doesn't change action.
Sorry.
Rotation doesn't.
Well, I mean, a global rotation, of course, doesn't. Yeah, exactly. Some sort of like local twisting. So basically, what looks like some sort of vortex motion, as long as it's time independent, is not going to change the action at all. So it's not that you can choose coordinates which seem twisted. It really is that I can somehow grab the physical elements, move them around, and I'm not punished for that. Whereas for like a solid, I would be. Or a jelly. Yeah. Okay, so we have these ingredients B, B B squared, B cubed. Now, for doing cosmology, it is most convenient to actually write your variables this way. And the reason is basically because we want to have one term that encapsulates sort of the dilation of our fluid, and then these others will encapsulate some of the various sorts of twisting and stretching of it. All right, so this is fair to do, and we just find it convenient. So the important thing is that this guy here, we call X. The others we call Y and Z. And X is the one that encodes sort of, this, again, the stretching of our solid. OK, so now that we have an action, and it's Lorentz invariant, it's very straightforward to couple it to gravity. So all we have to do is we have to replace that Minkowski metric here with just the inverse metric. And we just replace the measure with that. So we get the square root of the determinant.
Should I worry that I could imagine lots of configurations where your d vanishes with d squared, d cubed don't, and so on, where you down?
Yeah, I don't think b should be vanishing. For instance, around the background, it's just going to be the identity. Yeah, is there chalk? Oh, here we go. This is all the chalk I get, apparently. So this is B. And I guess the point is that phi is never basically zero in some sense. It always has this large background. And then you're going to have perturbations on top of that. So the trace of this is basically always going to be about three plus order pi. Yeah, I mean, at least our thinking sort of the entire way through is that we're always just doing effective field theory in these perturbations. And so you don't want your perturbations to be of order the function x because they'll be infinitely large. Yeah, in essence. So for all the physical things that we're going to calculate, that never is going to happen. Yeah, and I guess you're probably right that by... Okay.
No, so
is there a curvature singularity of the metric? When we actually well, I mean, it would just be the same for the usual FRW case. So, for instance, if we're... Yeah, I mean...
I think we should let them give us
OK. But yeah, OK. So the point is this looks sort of suspicious because you wonder if maybe there's something bad happening with these variables. But I think the way that we, at least physically, to avoid any of these issues, we're always just thinking about, you know, this. OK. All right, so we coupled the gravity in the usual way. We know how to do that. That's one benefit of having an action. And we can compute the stress energy tensor, which is going to give us the dynamics, at least around the background, of this sort of solid interacting with the gravitational field. OK, so we can compute about this background. So we really are computing about phi equals x, phi I equals xi. Bij takes this form, and it has an A in it because, again, of the inverse metric. The density and the density plus pressure, when you calculate T, take the usual sort of perfect fluid form, but only in the sense that it's diagonal and sort of the time-time component is different than all the space-space components. But again, there's nothing perfect fluid about this. But the density is given by this. The density and the pressure is given by this. These are the usual Friedmann equations. So the slow roll condition basically becomes, so if we want an inflationary universe that basically stays inflating at approximately the same rate, the slow roll condition is translated into this condition on the functional form of our sort of solid action. So let me just actually go back 1 second. So this function here, you can basically think about as determining the equation of state. So if you have some equation of state of your solid, you can actually determine what F is going to be. So for instance, when we computed the stress energy tensor, we said, well, it turns out that rho is equal to negative F, and rho plus P is equal to this derivative. So, and then if you have other, and again, these are all equilibrium statements, but choosing F is essentially the same as choosing the equation state. That's the take-home message there. Okay, so one would worry that you have a very sort of fine-tuned part of your action here, meaning that you require that this derivative is extremely small relative to the general size you would expect it to be. And maybe under quantum corrections, this is no longer going to be the case. But it's nice because this is protected under an approximate internal scale invariant. So there's an approximate symmetry that it protects it, this right here. So we shouldn't worry that somehow when we do the full quantum treatment that we're going to lose the ability to sort of have slow roll inflation. But again, nothing is really rolling here. There is no potential. But we still use that same language because it's convenient. For instance, you know, epsilon defined as h dot over h squared is still a good small parameter, so on and so forth. Okay. So that's the background. So we can have inflation happen, and it's protected by this approximate symmetry. So that's good. Now, everything interesting in inflation, of course, is the perturbations. So we need to compute what happens. OK, so we have three Goldstone bosons for the symmetries that we've broken. We can expand in them. And you get, this is what your Lagrangian looks like. So this is back to your question. This is the speed of sound squared, and then the transverse speed of sound squared. Which are just, again, their form is pretty obvious here. But of course, the subscript, sorry, I forgot to mention, represents the derivative, computed about the background value. So what's interesting here is that it seems like we have a lot of freedom with what these two things can be. And then we have this overall coefficient here. And then, of course, interactions, which basically take the form of derivatives of pi to some power times sort of these sorts of derivatives. OK, so even at quadratic level, there's an issue that we would worry about. And that issue is basically that we don't want these things to be superluminal. I guess as Kurt was mentioning yesterday, technically, there's often no inconsistency with having superluminal modes. But if we want a usual Lorentz invariant UV completion, we would probably like them to be subluminal. So let's just require that on our theory. And then the other problem is this thing here could possibly become very small, and you could have strong coupling issues. In particular, it looks like our slow roll condition was that epsilon is like f sub x times x over f. And so it looks like this factor here is the scale of the theory, f. Times the very small parameter epsilon. And so we could worry that somehow if these interactions are of order f, that somehow we're going to get this epsilon enhancement, and this epsilon enhancement is going to be so strong that we're going to have strong coupling, and that means that we have basically no perturbative control over our theory. So the slow roll condition would somehow imply strong coupling and no perturbative control, which means we can't calculate thing, our theory is useless. So those are two issues that we're going to have to check.
Do you have to worry about time becoming
I mean, you could, but I don't think. Yeah, you could worry about that, and I think what you just have to say is, well, you need this quantity to just always be positive. Yeah. Which I think is so. Again, the slow roll condition is given by this, and you know that F minus F is equal to rho. And so for positive epsilon, this necessarily has to be negative. So it's consistent in how you want it to be. But I mean, maybe if you had some crazy equation of state, you're pretty close to it being negative. And so that's worrisome. But maybe you can just somehow demand that equation
is ghostly. Like regular medicine, you want to get, you have to get close to the
But I think what's different about that situation is if you tilt the potential one way, it's going to roll down the hill one way. And if you tilt the other way, it's going to roll down the hill the other way. But epsilon's always positive. Exactly. So the point is, there's no way to make epsilon negative by tilting the potential. Whereas here, you can somehow tilt this f of x times x, tilt it, and you can have ghost-like degrees of freedom. So sort of worrisome, but the story seems consistent. Yeah. Sorry, say it again. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. So I guess the quick answer is we can consistently keep it under control, but it could be a problem. I would guess, but I don't think we've explicitly checked that. Yeah, but the point is, if you want, when epsilon is negative, does that imply that you've violated the neck? But I guess the background is still given by this function f and its derivatives determines the. So I guess we could look at the Friedman equations aside. So yeah, that's probably true. So if you violate the neck, my guess is that this is the case. Okay. So let me just restate that point. The point is that so aside from these ghost issues, the two other things we want to worry about are these. Speeds becoming larger than one. And then we're worried about strong coupling because we seem to have a very small parameter here and not necessarily small parameters in the interaction. So these are two things that are important to check. I mean, of course, we could just go through and start calculating things, but we want to make sure that our theory is sensible. Okay, so as far as the superluminality is concerned, another slow roll condition that people usually define is basically that you don't want epsilon to change too much during the course of inflation. So if we assume this, then this actually gives constraints on f sub x squared, or f sub xx, if you will. And what this means is that we can write to lowest order in slow roll. Cl takes this form, and Ct takes this form. Okay, so if we assume this second slow roll condition, we have this, and the important part is that they essentially CT and CL are going to share the same F sub Y, F sub Z combination, right? So if we can somehow make F sub Y plus F sub Z small, we can keep these guys under control, okay? So in particular, we'll just demand that this is the case. So subluminality will give us this, right? We want this to go basically like epsilon f. So it's, again, smaller than we would expect it to be. And unfortunately for us, there's no sort of approximate symmetry that we can find that actually keeps this, that makes this the case. So this is some sort of fine-tuning that we have to do in the model. Okay, so I'll rewrite them again. So they are, so we decided to, we had those three solid variables, those traces of the metric B, the matrix B, and it's convenient to make it that X is just the trace of B, and then Y is equal to the trace of B squared over B squared, and Z is, I think this is Y, and then Z is the one where it's just cubed. So this is just going to have to be some sort of fine-tuning in our model. Okay. But, there is an approximate symmetry that we can have, but the problem is that approximate symmetry is pretty uninteresting. So this symmetry would be that basically all derivatives of F are small. And there's nothing technically wrong with that. The only problem is then our model is really uninteresting because then all it is essentially a cosmological constant with this sort of weak solid hanging out around in the background. So it doesn't really give you interesting dynamics. So it is well controlled, but it's pretty boring. So we want to take the sort of riskier bet, which is, well, we're going to have to do some fine tuning here, but maybe we can have some interesting interactions that are not necessarily epsilon suppressed. Okay. So now we have to really worry about strong coupling, because now we've decided that these interactions are not epsilon suppressed. So what we want for inflation is we want the strong coupling scale to always be much, much larger than Hubble during the entire period of inflation. And so this means that we can trust our effective field theory the entire way through. Okay, so again, this is sort of the kinetic term has this sort of form. This is small. Yeah. We'll see in a moment why. I mean, epsilon we would like to be small. Because we basically want this. We want inflation. So epsilon being small is basically a statement that you're having almost de Sitter, right? Now, eta being small doesn't seem to be, you know, why do we need this extra thing? And I think we'll actually see why it's a problem in a moment for a slightly different reason. But I think, I mean, I think it still has a similar. I see. Okay. Yeah. I don't know. That's a good point. But it's certainly if you want epsilon to be small, and then you take eta not to be one, there's problems, and we'll see why that's the case actually in just a moment. So to eta to be of order one. Epsilon small gives you problems. Okay, so here's, again, the strong coupling story. So this is the more interesting choice, is that these derivatives are of order F, and it's the combination of these two particular guys that happens to be small. CL and CT, we can take them to be of order one. You get some strong coupling scale, and you see that, indeed, this is satisfied. If you want to include small speeds of sound, you need this to be satisfied. So as long as your eta isn't exactly zero or CL isn't exactly zero, this is also going to give you a condition. So you want this to hold, which gives you this condition. And so you have sort of this condition on eta times CL. But given that this is so small here, this is very easy to satisfy generically. So basically the point is, it seems like we're going to have very strong coupling. Do we have to worry about it from an effective field theory point of view? Can we actually track perturbations all the way through inflation? The answer is yes. No, yes, you worried, but then we checked, and your worry is gone. There is no worry. The two-point function you can always sort of change just by the scale of inflation. So that you match to experiment. So then the interesting thing to compare is really the non-Gaussianities in comparison to the two-point function. And what we find is we find an epsilon enhancement of our non-Gaussianities, which is exactly this line here. So this danger has basically become an exciting feature, because what it means is we have very large non-Gaussianities. And you're talking about the tensor and the sorry.
So the tensor is here, will still just go to H squared.
Yeah. Okay.
So if your scalar still goes H squared over.
We have the same sort of scalar to tensor ratio. Yeah, it's quoted at the end, and I think maybe there's some speed of sound difference, but I think it's basically the same story, in terms of epsilon at least. But that's actually what's really interesting, is an actual perfect fluid with all 3 degrees of freedom doesn't make sense here. So if you have a perfect fluid described by a single degree of freedom, essentially a superfluid, that basically fits in the usual effective field theory of inflation, and you can calculate through and everything's perfectly well defined. But actually, as I guess I'll show in the next slide, actually doing it with a fluid is a problem. So I guess to finish this comment, we were worried because these things looked big. So are they under control? Yes. But since they're big, they also become interesting. Okay, and with regards to your question, why not a fluid, right? Because a fluid seems like the subset, and usually people say people like to model fluids in cosmology, and they usually do it with just this single scalar field, sort of this P of X action. So what goes wrong? So in a perfect fluid, CT is equal to zero, in addition to higher order terms being restricted by the symmetry. But this volume-preserving diffeomorphism symmetry fixes CT to be zero. Why is that a problem? Okay, well, when CT is equal to zero, we can rewrite, when you rewrite CT, it looks like this. This is to all orders in slow roll. In some sense, we have just converted these derivatives with respect to x and these derivatives with respect to xx into these two slow roll parameters. So this is an exact equality. So the problem is, when you want CT to be zero, well, epsilon we demanded is small. Now maybe we can relax that assumption, but eta we now have to have of order minus one in order that this whole sum is zero, right? Now the problem is, when eta is of order minus one, since eta, this is eta by definition, it basically means that epsilon has to decrease by an order one factor every single Hubble time. Okay? Now F is going to be constant, because F is just like rho, which we need to be constant from the Friedman equations. And so what this means is, this means F sub x times x decreases by an exponentially small factor over the entire time of inflation. So if you want e to the 60, this factor is going to have to go down of order e to the 60. Right, that's a problem, because this is the quantity that controls your strong coupling scale. And so what's going to happen is, it's not really that, I mean, there are So we actually have a paper a few years ago about why quantum mechanics of perfect fluids is very tricky at zero temperature. And this is not even that argument. This is a different argument. This is that if you tried to have some inflationary universe driven by a perfect fluid, you would essentially just, you'd have strongly coupled modes very fast, no matter how you tried to play with your model. So that's sort of why, that's why fluids, a perfect fluid with all 3 degrees of freedom fails. You mean eta? Yeah, but well, if this guy's large, I don't think there's a problem from perturbation theory. We're worried about him being small.
This doesn't make any sense because, I mean, we know at the end of the day you can pick up regular inflation
as a perfect fluid.
As a perfect fluid.
Yeah, but it's no longer inflating. That's the difference.
It's no longer
inflating. So after reheating, you have a perfect fluid, but it doesn't go
through.
Exactly.
Whatever you are doing.
But yeah.
You can always think of a scalar field as a fluid. And then what you're saying here right now is that somehow this doesn't make sense when you go through it. But we know that regular inflation.
Okay. So you're saying we can think of a scalar field as a fluid. Well, we know by definition that a fluid actually has 3 degrees of freedom. So we cannot think of a scalar field as a normal perfect fluid. But you can think of a scalar field as a superfluid. So a superfluid has a single scalar degree of freedom. In fact, breaks time translations. So it actually fits perfectly into this effective field theory of inflation type situation. So this is the background is now just time. And then you have perturbations around that. But the point is, since you have just one scalar, everything's well controlled. So I think that language is a little misleading because people say, this is a fluid, but it isn't a fluid. It has 1 degree of freedom. They have a different number of degrees of freedom.
No, it has 3 degrees of freedom. There's probably no property or no constraint.
So I mean, you can write, but how does it have 3 degrees of freedom if two of them don't propagate?
Well, but you could have fluids that have gradient flows, and that's...
Yeah, but I think there's an important difference. So if you actually... So classically, if you set the vorticity to zero, the vorticity always stays zero. So classically, you can actually map a perfect fluid with 3-fold degrees of freedom into this potential flow with just a single degree of freedom. Now, the problem is quantum mechanically, that's not the case because it will explore those degrees of freedom. They're there. And so I think that's the difference.
But if you say there is a different problem at the classical level, because the speed of sound are...
Well, this is... but this is a quantum mechanical argument. We're talking about quantum mechanical strong coupling here. No, there's nothing wrong. There's nothing wrong with setting this to zero. Just then, we require that this guy happens to be of order one.
Here's a confusion. So, if I had a perfect fluid and then I set vorticity annotation to zero, would a scalar field be a good description of that or not?
Classically, yes. I think it's just there must be some sort of discontinuity there. There's something interesting about that sort of duality that people usually quote, and I think there's some subtlety there that has yet to be fully explored. Because certainly, if you use a single scalar, you can sort of get away with everything. But I think there really is something different with using the full degrees of freedom of the perfect fluid. Even if you set the initial vorticity to zero, quantum mechanically, it's going to explore these other degrees of freedom, and they're going to get you into trouble. Yeah. Okay. So yeah, I guess to finish this argument, the point is that this guy tracks this. This thing will become exponentially small. You can't avoid strong coupling. So that's the sort of argument of why can't we just do the same thing with a perfect fluid? So we need a solid to have this model. Okay. So this is back to the old side. So we just talked about all the internal symmetries, right? Now back to the other question, which is a standard complaint, which is that you need a clock in inflation. So there is no clock in phi I equals xi. This looks sort of clock-free. So what's playing the role of the clock? The metric is playing the role of the clock. So let me explain how that exactly works. So for instance, why do you need a clock? Well, you need inflation to end. So even if it looks exactly de Sitter for a while, something needs to happen so that the universe becomes what we see now. And our fields have no time dependence. But the metric is explicitly time dependence because it has factors of a of t in it. So for instance, x, which is given by this, has time dependence. Also, rho has time dependence. P has time dependence. So you have a clock in this sense that, you know, physical observables have explicit time dependence, but that doesn't mean that you conform to the same symmetry breaking pattern as effective field theory. So I think that that's an important point. So somehow the logic usually glows. Yes. So the logic usually goes, well, I need something that drives inflation that is explicitly time dependent. Because it's explicitly time dependent, it's going to have Goldstone bosons associated with that spontaneous breaking. But what's important is that these sort of time dependent variables, for instance, rho and p here, are not the fundamental degrees of freedom. Right? And so, you know, that seems sort of like a silly point, but it's important for counting, for figuring out the exact symmetry breaking pattern of your theory. So just as a sort of trivial example of why knowing what the fundamental degrees of freedom are is important. I mean, if you take the action of just like a point particle, so x dot squared, right? And if you say that your fundamental degree of freedom is just v, then you just get that Fourier equation of motion, you just get that v is zero. But of course, if you know that your fundamental degree of freedom is actually x dot, then you get, you know, usual Newton's law, right, which has more solutions and is more interesting. And so somehow identifying the correct degrees of freedom changes this picture. So if our degrees of freedom actually have this symmetry breaking pattern, you can still have these time dependent functions which drive inflation. But there is a different symmetry pattern different symmetry breaking pattern associated with it. So I think what had happened was sort of there was an assumption that in some sense fields like this were just, since they were time dependent, they had to be given by time dependent that your matter degrees of freedom also had to be time dependent, and that's not true. And we have this example to demonstrate that it's not true. Yeah, but the point is, if you just have a cosmological constant, then you don't need a clock, would be their logic there. Because the clock is so that you have a little bit of slow roll so that inflation ends at some point. You need something which says, all right, it's been 60 E folds, like, let's get out of here.
So you're saying that in the case of there's no good clock?
No, yeah, there's no good clock. Okay. Okay, so the metric is time dependent. All these things are time dependent. So how is inflation going to end? Well, inflation is going to end when, let's say, the determinant of this quantity, which gives us, you know, the overall compression, reaches some critical value. Because this guy is going to have some A of t's in it for the same reason that x does. Right? So this determinant is just going to, it's going to change as inflation happens. And when it reaches some critical value, we have reheating. Yeah? Yeah.
This condition for me, it doesn't seem like it's associated at all with the breakdown of slow roll.
Well, but it kind of is, in the way that what's going to happen is, I mean, this is a crazy solid. It's a solid that can be basically stretched a lot, and it doesn't really care. But what happens is at some point it reaches a critical value, and what's going to happen is that it just is going to go through some phase transition. So this is like, let's say, solid helium at zero temperature. When you apply significant pressure to it, I think it's like, I don't know, say you're at 50 atmospheres, and then you have a dial and you tune that all the way down to 25 atmospheres, I think, is when it suddenly becomes liquid helium or superfluid helium. And the point is that somehow there's a phase transition at some critical value. So it's in some sense the same logic, where you have some kind of equation of state that can exist for over a large range of this determinant, but then at some critical value, something rapidly changes, just like the potential, you know, rapidly steepens.
And it's so kind of a new inflation idea that there is this feature that's a bend in the potential, using that it's a bend in my equation of state.
Exactly.
It's solid to a point, and then it breaks and turns into something else.
That's exactly what's going on. Yeah. So it's very similar to the same slow roll type logic, except nothing's of course rolling. So yeah, this is exactly what's happening. And given our discussion with fluids, what's really going on is you have some sort of surface that is giving us, well, yeah, surface in this sense, that's giving us some sort of symmetry enhancement. So we have our solid, it reaches some critical value, and then you have a change in the symmetry of your theory. It becomes more enhanced, but importantly, it's described by the same degrees of freedom. And that's really nice because that allows us to actually continue through this period of reheating. We can map variables from one side into variables from another side. Yeah?
So for a given perturbation mode, you just basically evolve it until that time? And then...
Yeah. So this is going to be something that's going to come up a little later. So hopefully it won't sort of destroy the magic. But the point is we don't actually have... conserved adiabatic modes outside the horizon. So the usual story with inflation is it's great because outside the horizon, these adiabatic modes are conserved. And then basically whatever happens to the universe, they're still conserved. So even if you know nothing about reheating, which is basically this period of complication that the universe passes through, you can still predict stuff about what we're going to see in the sky. And so our problem is we don't have that feature exactly. In fact, what we have is we sort of have like a slow roll time dependent, so it's very weakly time dependent, but it still is time dependent. And so what happens is we actually need to have some sort of model for reheating, but our model can be pretty crude. Like I said, because you have the same degrees of freedom on one side as the other side. So you just require something like, well, it happens instantaneously, there's an equation of state, there's an equation of state change that's essentially theta function-like, but you can, equation of state is discontinuous, which means that the equations of motion are discontinuous, but you have a set of variables that you can continue across because you demand that they're continuous across the surface. Yeah. Did that answer your question? Okay. Okay, I think I said these things. And basically what we want is we want something that happens essentially instantaneous, which basically means that this phase transition happens faster than a Hubble time. And this is an assumption that we would maybe like to relax at some point, and it'd be interesting to relax, but this is sort of a first pass at reheating. So it's a little unnerving that we have to assume some facts about reheating, but the model, or these conditions are pretty general, I'd say.
You don't have a microscopic picture.
No, but you know, in some sense you don't want a microscopic picture. Well, we don't have the microscopic degrees of freedom of inflation necessarily, and so it would be, from the effective field theory point of view, it's... I mean, you have some really complicated plasma-like thing. It makes much more sense to describe it in terms of thermodynamic quantities and, you know, large wavelength perturbations than it does to describe it in terms of, like, electrons and photons and stuff like that. So I think... from the effective field theory point of view, it's much nicer to have the long wavelength discrete. I mean, it would be interesting to have an exact particle physics model that somehow realizes this, but I think that's hard to do. And the family of such models, which will maybe, you know, give you slightly different things, is so vast that maybe it's...
Yeah,
But I think the difference there is that there you're trying to actually understand the details of reheating, because as far as the adiabatic modes are concerned, they're insensitive to that, right? Yeah, no, so yeah, we have no microscopic description of what that is, and for our purposes, that's not a problem. Yeah.
So you're saying there could be some other more fundamental degrees of freedom that end up looking like this a lot?
Yeah, that's the idea. I mean, yeah, this is an effective field theory all the way through. So in no way do we actually think that this solid, like these degrees of freedom of the solid really are, you know, the UV degrees of freedom of our theory. I mean, certainly they're not. I mean, our theory is not, you know, it has a cutoff scale, so it's only valid to some energy anyways. So it's explicitly not a microscopic degree of microscopic description of what's going on. So rather, maybe you have some, you know, really exotic condensed early universe condensed matter thing that's going on. But what's making that happen? Who knows? I mean, the point here really should be something along the lines of there's a different sort of symmetry breaking pattern in the universe that could go on and give you different sort of give you a different picture of what's happening during inflation than the usual effective field theory of inflation one. But it still is an effective field theory. There is no microscopic description. Okay, so just we can tell you that we kind of know what we're doing. Here, for instance, is a simple realization of, you know, a situation where this phase transition would happen. So you just require that F has this functional form, and it's just discontinuous at some density, OK? All right, so now there's another interesting problem, or maybe an interesting feature in our model. Usually people talk about these two quantities, R and zeta, as the adiabatic modes. And usually they're equal. So you can choose whichever one you want to talk about. Now what's interesting for us, so like I said, outside of the horizon, excuse me, they are equal. And in particular, they're time independent. So we find that these things actually have a slight time dependence. And maybe even more interesting is the fact that R and zeta are not actually equal outside the horizon. And so this begs a question, which ones do we calculate? Because when we calculate all the way up to this sort of phase transition and then try and continue our variables through, which two-point function do we want? Do we want the two-point function of R? Do we want the two-point function of zeta? So in the usual case, it doesn't matter. They're the same outside the horizon. But for us, it is going to matter. And what's interesting is that zeta is continuous across this reheating surface, whereas R is explicitly discontinuous. So the thing that's going to survive after this reheating surface is only zeta. Okay? So that's actually the variable that we want to choose to calculate with. Sorry, say it again. Well, yeah, it depends on the theory. In terms of in unitary gauge, or there's sort of gauge invariant ways to define them in terms of fluctuations of the metric and fluctuations of t mu nu. And they look very different. And so in the standard inflationary case, it's almost surprising that they are exactly equal. For us, what's interesting about them is that zeta tracks pi. So I think zeta up to a constant looks like this, whereas R is totally crazy and in unitary gauge contains things like h dots, among other things. There's stuff in the denominator that's non-local. So it's a totally crazy variable in comparison to zeta. And also, because it has h dot and the equations of motion are going to be discontinuous across the surface, h dot is discontinuous across the surface. So R is discontinuous across the surface. So we shouldn't trust R. That's the point. OK, so I basically have, I don't know, 2 minutes. I know I started a little late. So let's just calculate the perturbations, which is sort of, you know, all of the work. And I'm really just going to present it in just a few slides. So we have these fluctuations. We work in spatially flat slicing gauge. Here's zeta. So there's that numerical coefficient. We can calculate the two-point functions. of the scalars, the gravitational waves. We can calculate the three-point function. Let's talk about the two-point function first. Okay, like I was saying before, this is really interesting because we have no adiabatic modes. These things are not time independent, which is seems like it violates, you know, deep theorems of various people. But it's true. I mean, you can just calculate it and see it explicitly. But we actually have sort of a, there's some logic behind why this should actually be the case, which I can explain if you guys are interested. Anyways, here's the two-point functions. So here's your scalar-tensor ratio, tensor-scalar ratio. Yeah, yeah, exactly.
CT? CT
actually can't be too small. Okay. I think it's like, it has to be greater than a third or something like that. So you can't make CT super small, you can make CL, well, provided you want all the strong coupling stuff to work, you don't want to make CT much smaller than, I think, a third or something like that.
So that makes epsilon small.
Yeah, epsilon is explicitly small everywhere.
Right, I just mean that justifies your requirement that epsilon be small.
Yes. See, where's CT here?
I'm looking at the two-point function for zeta in the exponent.
Ah, here you're saying. Yes. Okay, no, sorry. Okay. So remember how we were talking about this this time dependence?
Yeah.
So this is just a relic of the fact that we have these things are not exactly they don't become constant outside the horizon. So these are actually going to be order one factors, and order one in like the true sense, meaning like two or something. Yeah, so that's why they're tagging along and they look sort of ugly, but they're only going to be order one.
You mean if that exponent is big, that's not going to end up contributing? That's an order one, but potentially k-independent factor.
Well, this exponent is always order epsilon because CT is of order one. And this thing here is going to be insanely small. So e to the minus 60, but then it's e to the minus 60 to epsilon, which is of order, depend on what, let's say epsilon is. Yeah, I mean it's.
I get it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Ignore.
Okay. Yeah.
So perfect fluid is CT is 0, right?
Yes.
So that's why.
Yeah, but I mean, you could maybe tell yourself that, but I wouldn't even trust this computation because we were saying, look, there's some strong coupling scale, so at some point we should be like, we don't know what we're doing. So yeah, maybe.
I guess it's comforting to me.
Yes.
The independence of data is coming from something that I would expect not to be there for expected fluid.
Yes, that is true. That is true.
And then maybe
oh, this you mean? It's just supposed to be scalar.
No, that 5S.
On the same. Oh, S. S is the slow roll. Thank you. So S is the slow roll parameter that describes the time evolution of the sound speed. So it's defined. It's basically CL dot over HCL. So yeah, you just basically, it's how slowly the time speed varies during the whole inflationary
stuff. And that's guaranteed to be slow in your model as
well? It is actually in our model. Yeah, it's guaranteed to be slow. You don't even have to, it's not even an assumption that we have to make. It's automatically slow. Okay, this thing is important. Our tensor tilt is blue shifted, which is very, very hard to do in standard models. Fact, okay. Here's our three-point function. Usually people write it in terms of this Newtonian potential during matter domination, which basically just gives us this factor of 3/5. But if we write everything in terms of these variables, what we find is this is our two-point function. right? We fit this to experiment. We know that it's about this big. And then we can define quantities like F and L through these usual sorts of definitions. And this is what our F and L is going to be. And so, like we said, let's assume the most interesting sort of model where F sub Y is of order F. Well, this is an order one coefficient. And so what we have is a huge F and L. It's instead of epsilon suppressed or CL enhanced, we have both that it's CL enhanced and it's epsilon enhanced. So if you have small speed of sound single field models, I think you just basically cover up the epsilon here. That's what your F and L looks like. So we have this additional epsilon enhancement, which could potentially be huge, but also it's like, well, then why don't we see it? And the answer as to why don't we see it is because our three-point function has a totally new shape. And in fact, what it has is it has a, in the squeezed limit, it has this sort of angle of approach functional dependence, which is really important because what it means is it means it effectively has a 2% overlap with the local shape. Right? Which means if you go out into the sky and you look for local non-Gaussianities, because basically every model has some kind of like local contribution, what you find is you find that if this signal was actually in the sky, you'd essentially miss it completely.
So it's huge, but not huge enough to ruin your strong coupling.
Yeah, I mean, exactly, yeah. Okay, so this is interesting. It also violates the so-called consistency relations, which are statements about essentially what the three-point function has to look like in the squeezed limit. So the consistency relation is basically a statement that for a large class of models, you expect that the three-point function to basically be suppressed by the, I think it's the scalar tilt, and you need it to have explicitly zero theta dependence here. And so we sort of violate it in both ways. Not only are we enhanced by epsilon, the F and L, but we also have this theta function dependence, which is which all of this, basically everything interesting in this model, stems from the fact that the usual logic of if I have a long wavelength perturbation, I can always zoom in and I see that this locally, I see that this long wavelength perturbation just looks like a little bit of time evolution of my universe, meaning I can't, it's still isotropic. Whereas in our model, if you have a long wavelength perturbation and you zoom in, you can't run the same argument because there's anisotropic stresses that are order one. So you can still tell, even for the longitudinal mode, a long wavelength longitudinal mode, you can still tell that like the solid is stretched in some preferred direction. And so that breaks so much of the logic that allows you to derive these sorts of results. Okay, so sorry that took a little bit over time and we started late, so it's like doubly over, but this is a summary of the highlights. So we have a new symmetry breaking pattern. It's very different. And because of that, it breaks a lot of the sort of the canonical set of intuition. In particular, we have no adiabatic modes, so that violates a whole set of theorems which were thought to be super general. We have a blue-shifted tensor tilt, which is very unusual. We have huge non-Gaussianities generically, and we have an interesting shape which doesn't, I don't think anyone else has seen before, so that's interesting in and of itself. And we have a tension, this is something I didn't explicitly mention, we have a tension between the tilt and F and L, meaning that the size of the tilt goes like epsilon times CL squared, and then the piece in the denominator of F and L also goes like epsilon CL squared. So if you make the tilt super small by experimental constraints, then by necessarily the non-Gaussianity has to be huge, and vice versa. So if you tune these parameters, there's a little bit of tension. There's a little bit of tension there. Okay, so the future, we're actually trying to see if we can find this in the CMB. In particular, Kendrick Smith has some awesome codes that he's trying to run. And we can add sort of the super fluid component, maybe do a super solid, which would actually be sort of the most general symmetry breaking pattern of all. And we can relax this assumption about reheating. And there's this, we can maybe even have a sort of crystal structure, which actually gives us an isotropic two-point function, but a non-isotropic three-point function, which would maybe be interesting. So thank you. Appreciate it.
Solomon had tons of questions during the talk.